The author, playwright, politician, and commentator Gore Vidal, whose vast and sharpened range of published works and public remarks were stamped by his modest wit and unconventional wisdom, died yesterday at age 86 in Los Angeles from complications from pneumonia. His works included hundreds of essays, the best-selling novels Lincoln and Myra Breckinridge, and the Tony-nominated play The Best Man, now seeing a revival on Broadway. In 2006, he wrote the second volume of his memoirs, Point to Point Navigation, which looked at the years 1964 to 2006. We remember Gore Vidal this morning by hearing that interview and beginning our conversation by his recollections of running for Congress in the Hudson Valley in 1962. What was that congressional run like for you?
Well, it was an interesting year because Kennedy, a friend of mine, had been nominated for president, and I was a New York delegate to the convention that nominated him in Los Angeles. So it was sort of fun. Jack was running. I was running. I got him to come up to Hyde Park. Well, he had to come to Hyde Park. Mrs. Roosevelt had to vet him. She was in favor of Adlai Stevenson and was rather upset that Stevenson was not the candidate. So it was an edgy time. The 29th District was five counties. It was Ulster, Dutchess, Columbia, Greene, and Schoharie. I carried all the cities, Poughkeepsie, Catskill, Beacon, and lost the countryside to a kind of automatic Republican vote, which has been going on since the days of the good President McKinley. We had a congressman, J. Ernest Wharton, he was called, and he had no name recognition at all after being about 8-10 years in Congress. So I had all that because I had done a lot of television. And then I campaigned the district for over a year. So I spoke in practically every village. It was a big, big district, long since gerrymandered into several pieces.
Did you consider running again?
Well, I was obliged to because the party leaders wanted me to, first of all, run again in 64, which we knew I would win because the numbers were very good in advance, and that was also the Lyndon Johnson landslide against Goldwater. But I remembered something. Kennedy by then was dead, so much of the fun had gone out of it. But I remembered he said, "You're running for the House." He said, "That's a can of worms. You'll hate it." I did. And I said, "Well, must start at some point, since I'd rather be in the Senate, of course." But by then I was going back to writing novels and moved to Rome, not to live, but to do research for a book about the Emperor Julian. Mm-hmm. And I was in the middle of that, and I preferred doing that to going back to the hustings.
You say that American history is a family affair for you.
Yes.
How so?
Also, we've been around since the beginning of the Republic. My great-great-grandfather was born, I can't remember what number he was, but he was born in 1776, which was an omen. And we've been involved in politics, particularly the South. My great-grandfather founded the People's Party, sometimes known as Populists, which was sometimes very, very popular at the moment anyway. The Democratic Party is suddenly talking about populism, not as something quaint or something outmoded, but as something which means that the people are, to at least a minimum degree, involved in the governance of the United States, which is what the founders had in mind, but never got around to correcting. So, 1898, the Gores of Mississippi were working with like-minded people, mostly farmers who had been ruined by the Civil War, in starting a new party to balance the all-powerful Republican Party at that moment. So from that beginning, and my grandfather in turn was a great orator, a great speaker, And then he went out to the Indian territories, organized them as the state of Oklahoma, and was elected the first senator in 1907 and served till 1937. And I was brought up in his house.
You were his guide. He was blind.
I was a guide, yeah. He was blind from the age of 10. Yeah, I used to take him on the floor of the Senate, and he had a lot of signals. I'd have to sit in the gallery, and then if he put his hand on his head, many wanted him to go to the bathroom. And also some other signals, like, get me out of here.
You say he was a populist who didn't like people.
He was a populist who didn't like people very much. He used to say, if there was any race other than the human race, I'd go join it.
How do you differ from him politically?
Well, he'd be horrified at my politics. I mean, he was deep Well, he was a kind of socialist at the beginning. And he wrote a good deal of the Constitution of the State of Oklahoma, which was the first socialist state constitution in the country, and last also. In other words, why was it socialist? He came out for the nationalization of the railroads, because they were the great centers of corruption politically. Everybody was on the take, practically the entire Senate and House were all creatures of the railroads. And he thought, well, they should be taken over by the government. They've caused too much damage and trouble. So he'd be very much against the Republican Party of today, which is an heir to that era.
How political were your parents? Your mother was a flapper.
She burned with a beautiful light, as Edna St. Vincent Millay might put it. My father was an army man. He graduated from West Point. 1917, he was one of the first army flyers. And was sent overseas just as the war was ending, which bothered him. He came back, got out of the army, a peacetime army, did not appeal to him. Started three airlines. One of them became TWA, another one became Eastern. And he was director of air commerce under FDR. He was marinated in politics in that job, and he rather hated politics and really hated politicians.
Do you hate politicians?
I don't generalize about these things. I hate some of them, yes.
You have, in the book, you write about just the amazing people that you have met. You knew Amelia Earhart.
Well, she's my father's dearest friend and collaborator on three of the airlines that he had invented. And he lost all three because he never made a fortune. The airline business was the worst business in the country, and it was the hottest subject, which is a contradiction in terms almost. No one ever made a penny out of airlines. So what happened is a lot of small ones kept merging and became bigger and bigger and bigger. But he did not want to be an executive. He didn't want to have to go to an office and look after maintenance. So he would just start another airline. And Amelia, he brought in really because women were afraid of flying. And here was this woman who was handsome and a very brilliant woman, wonderful poet. And I've often wondered whatever happened to her poetry. My father had some of it. She would send him poems as she wrote them. And sometimes she sent a couple of me, which I have kept. But I'd like to see a book of them. And she was unusual. And the fact that she flew and had flown the Atlantic and so on, it wasn't that women were afraid to fly themselves in commercial airliners. It was they didn't want their husbands to fly because too many people crashed in the early days. I can remember a period in which everybody we knew had a neck brace. I just thought that's what grown-ups are like. They just wear neck braces, having crashed someplace in the United States.
Another person that you write about in the book is Johnny Carson, whose show obviously you appeared on frequently. What made Carson different?
Well, he was much more intelligent than the people we now have on offer, giving us our TV fare. He really was bright. very thoughtful, understood politics perfectly, and was very intrigued by it, too. But he had many interests, and we were just on the same wavelength. And it began, I was the only guest from Jack Parr, who had been doing it before, Johnny, that he kept on. In our moment of when we became one, I was quoting Richard Nixon. I used to be able to do a pretty good Nixon imitation, which I can no longer do. And I was quoting from Six Crises, a book he had written. One of the crises was running for president, which, you know, Nixon was the obvious man. I suddenly did my Nixon voice. Nixon wrote, "General Eisenhower was a far more sly and devious man than people suspected. And I mean those words in their very best sense." Carson did a double take and nearly fell out of his chair. And from then on, whenever somebody came up, we were characterizing as being a rather unpleasant fellow. Carson always said, "And you mean that in the very best sense of those words? Yes, yes, he's a fool, yeah."
Along with such contemporaries as Norman Mailer and Truman Capote, Gore Vidal was among the last generation of literary writers who were also genuine celebrities, regulars on talk shows like Carson and in gossip columns, personalities of such size and appeal that even those who hadn't read their books knew their names. Vidal appeared cold and cynical on the surface, dispassionately predicting the fall of democracy, the American empire's decline, or the end of literature, something we talked about in 2006.
Actually, I do nothing but praise writers. I don't attack writers, either personally or their writing. If a writer can attract an audience, I'm all for him, even if I can't stand what he writes.
Mm-hmm.
Because from the beginning, we've had more good writers than we've had good readers. So why discourage the energy that the New York Times puts into trying to keep people from reading books? I mean, has been so intense. We could have built, another Athens here with the rage and fury with which they go after, particularly after good writers. They can't stand it because most of them have failed, and this is a highly competitive, rather dim-witted society we have. They've spent too much time bad-mouthing the writers themselves. Had they been a little more intelligent, the New York Times book section would not be the cemetery that it is for talent. We've always had pretty good writers, the average amount for any country our size. But we don't have a very well-educated readership. And it goes back to the public school system, which is the worst in the first world. I mean, I've lived part of the time in Italy. I mean, there's no taxi driver who can't start quoting Dante to you. I mean, they know their culture. Ours have no knowledge of what writing is about, nor do they care.
You say that no novelist is famous because novels are not discussed in public anymore. How did we get to that point?
Television, I would think, and movies. They've, in a sense, used up entertainment time. Actually, it used to be thought that books were sort of good for you because you might learn something from them. And I'm not necessarily talking about novels, but, you know, literature of any sort. If you don't get into the habit of it, and if you're, I mean, the reports on the educational system all around the country are the same dismal ones. I mean, the kids are plainly bored to death. Minorities tend to drop out entirely and go off to work at some point in their teens. So there is really no sense of an interest in what used to be called liberal arts. Nor, alas, is there much interest in the United States of America, which happens to be my subject. And I find that pretty grim. I mean, we could not have had this last administration if the people knew anything about the country. But to sit there quietly, nobody made a noise. Well, if we had a public that was paying any attention, none of this could have happened. But they aren't. They're not used to it. They're not taught it. They don't know it.
Now that the Democrats have regained Congress, what do you think will happen?
Well, I hope there will be oversight and review as the Constitution requires. The Constitution is still in force in part, and that part is still in there. And I hope there will be a lot of investigations. I mean, where is that $500 billion that the Pentagon cannot account for? That used to be called a big scandal, you know, in the old days. And nobody seems to care. There's a lot of money. I think it's also too much money for any of us to absorb. I can't get all those zeros correct in my head. And I think most people have the same problem. But it is a problem, the way the money has been thrown away and burned up. You know, we are the only first world country that does not have decent education for the people at large, and that does not have health care for everybody, paid for by the government and out of taxes. All we have is the end of life. There's a little bit of Social Security, and that's it. And I can remember my grandfather introduced that in the Senate in 1935. And I remember the Republican cry was against Social Security. They wanted the old to starve to death. And their line was, if Social Security passes, you won't have a name, you'll only have a number. Oh, my God, John Smith was so upset. He wouldn't be John Smith anymore. He might be looked after in his old age, but he didn't want to be just a number. They have fought every advance, called it liberalism, and made liberals appear like demons. Without liberalism, we wouldn't have had a country at all.
You've stated a concern that point-to-point navigation might be a bit too grim. Are you feeling grim these days?
The fact at a certain point in your life, practically everybody you know is dead. That casts a bit of a shadow. But there's merriment to be had in the shade.
And when it comes to the future of this country, where does your optimism lie?
You want me to lie?
Sure.
Magnificent. Amber fields of grain. Alabaster cities shining in the sun. House on a hill. Beacons for all mankind. That's the lie. The reality will be, I think, that we're bound to come to our senses and get rid of the warmongers. And get rid of corporate America's spending of vast amounts of money in order to ensure that their lawyers go to the Congress and make sure that they don't have to pay any tax. That's what that's mostly about. I think the coming depression is going to straighten out a lot of things because there won't be the money to. I mean, they were all set to go into Iran, and now somebody looked up and said, "Hey, we can't afford it." When that gets through to them that they have really spent most of the money in the country for wars of aggression against other people. We had no business fighting in Iraq or Afghanistan. Then I think we might turn around and do something we should have done in 1945 when we were all victorious and the first global empire. Convert from war to peace. Because we've been at war ever since 1945. We've always found somebody to be aggressive against, whether it's Panama or Grenada, you name it, we've tried it. Because this is how many of our folks make their money.
The book is a memoir from 1964 to 2006, Point to Point Navigation. What would you like to be remembered for?
Oh, I hope nothing.
Really?
Listen, it's only the villains that are going to be remembered from this period. I don't want to be one of them.
Where do you think you've made an impact?
Well, all I know is that I attract larger and larger audiences wherever I speak. And I even tiptoed into Texas for a time recently. Austin, which is a wonderful city. And there are many like-minded people out there. I am hardly unique. It's only newspapers that make you seem uniquely crazy to want justice.
Do you think if you have unpopular beliefs, you come off as crazy?
They try and make you sound like that. Mm. I mean, the amount that you get misquoted. And sometimes it's so naked when that the congressman in pursuit of all those pages, Mr. Foley of Florida, the dreadful network, Fox, was immediately, you know, they were covering it in the news, and they were saying, and Congressman Foley, who was a Democrat, was writing love letters or whatever to pages. And they went right on pretending he was a Democrat for quite some time until I think somebody pulled the wire on them. Now, when they tell lies about you of such size and substance, it's difficult to deal with, but deal with we must.
Does it? You talked about those larger crowds. Does that make you feel good when you see that more people are showing up?
Well, of course it does, and also that more people are echoing me.
Gore Vidal speaking to us on the Roundtable on December 7th, 2006. Gore Vidal died in California on Tuesday. He was 86 years old. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.